Well, welcome all to this Weber training teleclass, Minimizing the Impact of Waterborne Bacteria on Hemodialysis Patients. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Zatar, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this teleclass today. Now that Syed and I have been running this teleclass series for a few years, we get to know which faculty are the most eloquent and interesting, and we invite them back to speak over and over again. Today's faculty is one of those. Dr. Richard Ward is a professor in the kidney disease program at the University of Louisville. In my research for this teleclass, I read one of his many journal articles that I found online. This one was called Methylglyoxal, a stimulant to neutrophil oxygen radical production in chronic renal failure. Now, in the reading of it, I concluded that Dr. Ward is a very bright guy and a very talented author, and I also concluded that my own knowledge of nephrology, particularly the terminology and pronunciation of those terms, is very small indeed. It's a real pleasure to have him present this teleclass lecture and to help at least me broaden my horizons a substantial amount, I hope. Without further discussion, to present the teleclass, Minimizing the Impact of Waterborne Bacteria on Hemodialysis Patients from the University of Louisville in Kentucky, I give you Dr. Richard Ward. Dick.
Thanks, Paul, and thank you for the introduction. Paul mentioned to me before we started that he'd been reading one of my papers on the web, and I had wondered which one it had been, and now I know why he was somewhat perplexed. But good afternoon, morning, or evening to all of you, wherever, whatever time zone you happen to be in. My topic for today is to talk about waterborne bacteria, how they affect hemodialysis patients, and what we can do as practitioners to try and minimize that effect. Now, if you would go to the next slide, please, you'll find an overview of my talk for this afternoon, which can, roughly speaking, be divided up into three segments. I'm going to start with a few introductory remarks to try and just set the scene by describing the role of dialysis fluid, which is what most people call it, or dialysate, which is the term we use in the United States. I'm not sure what Canadians call it, but both are synonymous. And what is the role of dialysis fluid in hemodialysis? Why is the microbiological quality of the dialysis fluid important? And how can we ensure on a day-by-day basis that we achieve safe levels of microbiological contaminants? Well, if you'll go to the next slide. The next slide is really just a little cartoon and a list which describes what hemodialysis is and what it is not. Well, hemodialysis is a process that essentially replaces the excretory functions of the kidney. So it removes water to maintain water balance. It regulates electrolyte levels, both anions and cations, and it eliminates the waste products of metabolism. What it does not do is replace any of the endocrine or metabolic functions of the kidney. So, for example, you may or may not know that the kidney is the primary source in the body of erythropoietin, the hormone that stimulates red cell production. And hemodialysis does nothing to replace the absence of erythropoietin production, which is why Amgen have done very well marketing their recombinant human erythropoietin. Little cartoon on the right-hand side of the slide then just shows some of the fluxes that are taking place. So you have blood on the right-hand side of a semipermeable membrane, and you have this dialysis fluid or dialysate flowing countercurrent on the other side of the membrane, and solutes pass backwards and forwards across the membrane, driven by either concentration gradients or pressure gradients. So for water, to move excess water from the blood into the dialysis fluid, we impose a pressure gradient across the membrane. To allow solute transport across the membrane, whether that be waste metabolites or electrolytes, we have a concentration gradient. For the most part, we're interested in having accumulated metabolites in the blood pass into the dialysate or the dialysis fluid so they can be discarded. And so we don't include those substances. That would be urea and creatinine and phosphate and substances like that. We don't include those in the dialysate, so there's a concentration gradient from blood to dialysate. On the other hand, one of the things dialysis has to do is to eliminate hydrogen ions, and that you really can't do by relying on diffusion of hydrogen ions because they're present in very low concentrations. We do it in a kind of roundabout way by allowing bicarbonate ions to pass from the dialysis fluid into the blood where they combine with the hydrogen ions to form water and CO2. So we have this two-way flux of solutes driven by concentration gradients and a flux of water driven by a pressure gradient, and this is all happening across a semipermeable membrane. And the next slide shows us now, just in cartoon form, a typical setup for dialysis. So we have some access to the blood, which is typically by inserting needles into a fistula created in the forearm. The blood is pumped out of one of those needles, anticoagulated by the addition of heparin, passes through the blood compartment of the dialyzer, and then passes back to the patient through a second needle. The dialysis fluid flows on the outside of the semipermeable membrane in a countercurrent to the dialyzer, to the blood flow rate, and comes in fresh, exchanges its solutes with the blood, and then passes out and goes to the drain. And we are concentrating today on the dialysis fluid. That's really our focus of interest. And the next slide shows in cartoon form how we make this stuff. Now, a typical dialysis uses several hundred liters of dialysis fluid. And so you understand that it's not practical to have that already prepackaged. And we get around that problem by making it as we use it from electrolyte concentrates and from water. So the dialysis machine, which is part of its function is to prepare the dialysate, takes water, it takes an acid concentrate, and it takes a so-called bicarbonate concentrate and mixes them together in the right proportions to form dialysis fluid of the right composition. We have two concentrates because the dialysate or the dialysis fluid has to contain both bicarbonate and calcium and magnesium. And some of you at least will be aware that if you try to make a concentrated solution that has both bicarbonate ions and calcium and magnesium ions in it, all you will get is limestone on the bottom of the container. So we separate them by having the calcium and magnesium ions in the so-called acid concentrate and the bicarbonate ions in the so-called bicarbonate concentrate, and they are proportioned separately so that they never see each other in a concentrated form, and we're able to form dialysate, a dilute dialysate, which has the right concentrations. The next slide shows this in a little bit more detail, to give you some idea of the mechanics of it. There are two sorts of systems shown here, a so-called fixed proportioning system and a dynamic proportioning system. The fixed proportioning system takes a fixed volume of water, heats it up, adds a fixed volume of acid, adds a fixed volume of bicarbonate, checks that the conductivity, which is a surrogate for the ionic content, is correct, and then passes this dialysis fluid to the dialyzer. The dynamic proportioning system has a little more versatility. It takes water at any flow and then uses servo-controlled pumps to add the acid concentrate and the bicarbonate concentrate to achieve some predetermined conductivity at each stage. It doesn't matter too much for the purposes of our conversation which one of these two methods we use. But it is important, I think, to understand that this involves water and a bicarbonate concentrate. Now, if we look at the next slide shows us why we are, in essence, why we are concerned about the quality of the dialysate. On the left-hand side of the slide is a little cartoon figure of someone with normal renal function. Someone with normal kidneys takes in about 14 liters of water a week in all forms. And they have a quite complex biological barrier between the water as it enters their GI tract and their bloodstream, and that's the cell layers of the GI tract, which is a pretty good barrier to anything that's undesirable in the water from entering the blood. Anything that does get into the blood across the GI tract can be excreted through the kidneys. And so a person with normal renal function sees a modest amount of water, has a protective barrier, and a means of elimination of anything that's bad in the water. The dialysis patient, who's shown as a cartoon in the right-hand side of the slide, is completely different in every regard. First of all, they see a very large volume of water every week. I've got 360 liters here, but with some modern dialysis treatments, that number may exceed 500 liters a week. Just to give you some kind of rule of thumb sense about what this means, a typical dialysis patient sees more water in 2 years than a healthy person sees in their lifetime. Now, the exposure of the patient's blood to that water occurs across a fairly non-selective membrane. We saw a couple of slides ago, this really is just a size barrier. Anything small will pass readily from the water into the blood. And then once it's in the blood, there's no real easy means of excretion because there's no kidney function. So a dialysis patient has very large exposure, no barrier, and no means of excretion. So that's why we need to be concerned about the quality of the dialysis fluid. Next slide. And the next slide shows in a tabular form a quality standard for the water that we use to prepare the dialysis solution. And this is the one for the United States. Other countries and regions have essentially the same standards, some very minor differences. And we have this because we have learned the hard way that there are things in water that are toxic to dialysis patients. And particularly this group of chemical contaminants in the upper right-hand side of the slide. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about what's in the bottom right-hand side of the slide, and that is microbiological contaminants. And in the United States, we have limits for the number of bacteria that we can have in that water and the amount of endotoxin we can have in that water. Now, other people have slightly different numbers, and we'll come back to talk about that later. But a consequence of this quality standard is that you cannot use tap water to dialyze anybody. Most of the substances in that top right corner that have proven toxicity for dialysis patients are commonly found in tap water. And so every dialysis unit requires some means of purifying the water before it makes the dialysis solution. And in the next slide, you see kind of a summary here of that kind of water treatment system. All dialysis facilities require one, because I think it is probably true that there is not a municipal water supply in the world that has good enough quality water every day for performing dialysis. The water treatment system must be capable of producing water of the appropriate quality from the worst case feed water. You probably are aware that your municipal tap water changes a little bit in quality throughout the year, depending on whether it's drought or not, whether it's winter or summer, and so forth. And you have to be able to deal with the worst possible feed water. You must be able to make enough water that you can keep your dialysis unit operating, and in fact, having some excess capacity is desirable because it's better to have a little bit much than a little bit less. And it should be, and we'll be coming back to this later, from a microbiological point of view, it absolutely should be designed to make it easy to maintain. Now, the next slide shows a typical water treatment system for a dialysis unit. So inlet tap water comes in, usually hot and cold. It's blended to a constant temperature and then subjected to a number of purification processes, of which these are typical. So depth filtration, filtration through activated carbon, softening, maybe some sort of submicron filtration, reverse osmosis, which removes most of the chemical contaminants and the microbiological contaminants. And then that purified water is either sent directly to the dialysis stations for use, or as shown in this slide, enters a storage tank, and then it is pumped from the storage tank to its point of use. So that's the water. We have to purify it for no other reason than because of the chemical contaminants. And what I would like to point out before we leave this slide, because it's very important for the rest of our conversation, is that almost always one of the steps in this water purification process is to pass the water through an activated carbon bed. Now, the reason we do that is to remove chlorine and or chloramines, the substances that are put in water to inhibit bacterial growth, because in particular chloramines have been shown over and over again to be very toxic to dialysis patients. Now, you will appreciate, if you think about it for not very long, that if you take out the substances that are used to suppress bacterial growth, at any point past there, you're likely to have unrestrained bacterial growth if you don't do something to prevent it. And so in fixing one problem, that is removing the chemical contaminant that we know is bad, we create an environment where we can produce a lot of bacterial contaminants. So, but of course, we don't treat our patients with water. We treat them with the dialysis fluid, which is this combination of water and concentrates that we saw earlier. And so what do we know about the purity requirements for that solution? Well, those are given on the next slide, at least for the U.S., which basically says that the final dialysis fluid will have the same purity quality as the water used to prepare it. So the chemical contaminants, same as for the water. Microbiological contaminants, same as for the water. Now, this is the situation in the United States. Other jurisdictions have a different view of this issue, particularly for the microbiological contaminants, and some of those are shown on the next slide. Well, the next slide shows a table of various definitions of microbiological quality. Let's see, the United States levels are at the top. The European Dialysis and Transplant Association, European Renal Association, best practice guidelines have a number for bacteria which is not really that different from 200, but a much lower level for endotoxin, which is 0.25 endotoxin units per mil. The third level in the table is something that I describe here as ultra-pure dialysis fluid, which has a much lower level of bacteria and a level of endotoxin, which is essentially the level of detection of the endotoxin assay. And just at the bottom, for comparative purposes, is what would be defined in the pharmaceutical industry as sterile. In other words, again, a very low level of endotoxin at the level of detection and a very small level of bacteria. Now, we don't pretend in dialysis to use sterile solutions, in part because there's no way to really qualify the solutions we make online at the time we're performing dialysis, there's no way to really qualify those as sterile in terms of showing that they have less than 10 to the minus 6 colony-forming units per mil of bacteria. But many people and organizations in the dialysis community strongly recommend that we should be using ultra-pure dialysate to treat our patients rather than the levels allowed by either the U.S. Guidelines or the European guidelines. And I'll try to review for you in the next few slides why that recommendation is being made, and then we will talk later about, if you accept that, how you're going to do it, because these are very low levels of microbiological contamination. The next slide is just a kind of introductory slide to the subject in terms of what it is that we have to worry about. Now, we have two sorts of microbiological contaminants that we can measure: bacteria and endotoxin. Now, I think that it's important for us to remember that there are other things that we can't easily measure. There are exotoxins produced by bacteria. There are fragments of bacterial DNA. There are all sorts of other things running around in water that are derived from waterborne bacteria, but they are not easy to measure. We don't try to measure them, but we shouldn't forget that they're there, and they may also be causing problems for our patients. So, again, turn to bacteria, which, of course, the large players here. It's important to recognize that bacteria won't cross an intact dialysis membrane. They're far too large. Blood cells don't cross bacteria, don't cross dialyzer membranes, neither do bacteria. However, if you're in a part of the world that practices multiple use of dialyzers, then you may get bacteria into the blood compartment when you're processing a dialyzer for reuse, because at that stage you put water into the blood compartment. And if you put contaminated water into the blood compartment, you can end up with sepsis, particularly if you have a sepsis characterized by a waterborne organism and you're practicing dialyzer reuse. It's very likely that that's where the bacteria came from. It is the chances of bacteria passing from the dialysis solution into the blood are vanishingly small. Now, on the other hand, endotoxin, which are fragments of bacterial cell wall, may cross dialyzer membranes, and they have been demonstrated to cross all types of dialyzer membranes, both open membranes and tight membranes, hydrophilic membranes, hydrophobic membranes. They may also contaminate the blood compartment during processing of dialyzers for reuse. And if endotoxin or endotoxin fragments get into the blood, they can cause a pyrogenic reaction in the patient, which is characterized by a syndrome of shaking chills, fever, and hypotension. And it is generally very marked. It's easy to see when it happens. And that's probably the large level effect that you see if you have a lot of endotoxin in the dialysis solution. The next slide shows that indeed there is a real dose response effect. The more bacteria and therefore presumably endotoxin there is in dialysis fluid, the higher the rate of pyrogenic reactions. Now, these are very old data from the mid-1970s, when dialysis was a very crude process compared with what it is today. And so I'm sure you're looking at these level of bacteria in the dialysis solution and saying, what do you mean more than 10,000 CFUs per mil? That's terrible. How can you possibly be that bad? Well, when dialysis was that crude, it was possible. And what you see is that as the dialysate bacterial count goes up from a fairly low level, or at least what we would consider perhaps to be an acceptable level today of 1 to 100 CFUs per mil, to something greater than 100, to something greater than 10,000, you see that the pyrogenic reaction rate goes up markedly from a few percent to perhaps as high as 25%. The next slide shows that this incidence or prevalence of pyrogenic reactions, rather, has increased over the years. So you see back in and these are data from the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, who for a long time used to collect this information from dialysis units every year. And you see back in the early 1980s that a relatively small percentage of dialysis centers would report pyrogenic reactions in a given year. So maybe in 1982 it was maybe 11%. But that number increased rapidly during the 1980s, and to the point where in the 1990s, somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of all dialysis facilities in the United States were reporting at least one pyrogenic reaction during the course of a year. Now you might ask yourself, well, why did that happen? Were we really that bad? Well, the answer is partially shown in the next slide. We changed the way we practiced dialysis, particularly in the 1980s, in three ways that, in one way or another, contributed to the increase in pyrogenic reactions. Now, at least two of these changes in how we practiced dialysis were undoubtedly real advances. The third one is arguable. But we certainly changed, the nature of dialysis membranes changed from being tight, relatively impermeable membranes to being much more open, permeable membranes. That's the difference between high-flux membranes and low-flux membranes. Now, that was very good in terms of removing those waste solutes from the patient, but it also probably opened up the membrane to the point where it made it easier for bacterial products to cross in the other direction. And you can see in the middle pair of bars here that if you were practicing using high-flux dialyzers, you had a higher rate of pyrogenic reactions than if you used low-flux dialyzers. But in balance, something that was better for our patients. In the right-hand pair of bars, you see the difference in pyrogenic reaction rate depending on whether bicarbonate was used in the dialysate as the source of base, or not said here, but the alternative was using acetate, which had been done for a long time to get around this problem of trying to proportion calcium, magnesium, and bicarbonate together. Acetate does not form a precipitate with calcium and magnesium and is metabolized in the body to generate bicarbonate, and was used for many years for that reason. But it had all sorts of other problems which we don't have time to go into today, and during the 1980s, there was the two concentrate proportioning systems were developed, and we went back to using bicarbonate. Bicarbonate is an excellent growth medium for bacteria, particularly in contrast to acetate. And so certainly as we learned how to use bicarbonate, we had a circumstance where we certainly had more contamination than we should have and more pyrogenic reactions. The third practice pattern change, the one I would say is the arguable one, is on the left-hand side, and that is the introduction of the practice of multiple use of dialyzers, which occurred in the United States particularly for driven by economical considerations. And in this case, where water is put into the blood compartment of the dialyzer and takes along with it any bacterial contaminants that might be in that water, it's perhaps not surprising that there were more pyrogenic reactions with dialyzer reuse than without it. So changes in practice affected the pyrogenic reactions by just essentially increasing the exposure of the patients to any contaminants that were in the water or dialysis solution. Now, it is interesting to see that very much whether you had pyrogenic reactions or not was very much a function of how careful you were in maintaining fluid quality. Now, this table is a summary of 10 clusters of pyrogenic reactions and septicemias that were investigated by the CDC in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And when I mean clusters, I mean this is where there were many patients affected at the same time, such that there was enough of a problem that the CDC were asked to investigate, well, why are we having all these pyrogenic reactions? And they tabulated the causes. And they, of course, needless to say, they found many causes. A lot of these were associated with dialyzer reuse, and they were associated with using incorrect germicide concentrations or inappropriate germicides and so forth. But I want you to focus on the bottom line, which showed that in every one of these outbreaks was associated with using water quality that did not meet the standards that were in place at that time, which were a little more wide open than they are now. So there's no question that contaminated water has the potential to cause bad things to happen to our patients. And to the extent that you can't miss them, a pyrogenic reaction, if it occurs, you see it, you know what it is immediately. There's no question about it. What has become apparent to us in the perhaps last 10 years now is that there's much more going on with contaminated dialysis solution than pyrogenic reactions. And that's summarized in the next slide. And that is that bacterial contaminants in the dialysis fluid can cause a syndrome of chronic inflammation in dialysis patients, such that various bacterially derived substances in the dialysis fluid, whether they are endotoxin fragments, peptidoglycans, muriel dipeptides, or exotoxins, may all cross both low and high flux membranes. They stimulate mononuclear cells to produce cytokines, and those cytokines ripple through the body's defense systems, increase levels of acute phase proteins, including everybody's favorite C-reactive protein. And that all these inflammatory mediators that are released produce a microinflammatory state in dialysis patients that's quite subtle in nature. But if it goes on for long enough, and we're talking about it potentially going on three times a week for years, that can play a role in various long-term disorders in dialysis patients, including the formation of beta-2 microglobulin amyloid, atherosclerosis, and malnutrition. And I'm going to show you in the next slide some examples of these sorts of changes. So the first, and what is the next slide, shows what happens to inflammation and to serum beta-2 microglobulin concentrations as a function of water quality. So this is a group of patients who are being dialyzed against a standard dialysis fluid, were switched to being treated with an ultra-pure dialysis fluid for 6 months, and then at the end switched back to standard. Now, pentosidine is an age compound that forms on proteins. It's a marker of inflammation, and you can see that ultra-pure dialysis fluids were associated with a decrease in pentosidine formation in the left-hand panel, and in the right-hand panel, a decrease in the serum concentrations of beta-2 microglobulin. Well, you might say, so what? And people do say, so what? Well, the so what, I think, is shown on the next slide. And what this shows is a 10-year follow-up of a group of almost 90 patients who were treated with either a standard dialysis fluid or an ultra pure, or, well, let me not say ultra pure, but a much more pure dialysis fluid. And what this looks at is the odds ratio of these patients developing a variety of beta 2 microglobulin amyloid associated diseases. So did they form amyloid? They were more than three times more likely to develop amyloid on the contaminated dialysis fluid. They were almost twice as likely to develop bone cysts, almost three times as likely to develop carpal tunnel syndrome, and nine times as likely to develop generalized arthropathy. So I think this shows in a kind of really clinical outcome measure that a situation that promotes beta 2 microglobulin amyloid deposition is definitely results in things that you would consider to be unpleasant side effects of a dialysis procedure at a minimum, and that those are associated with use of a contaminated dialysis fluid. The next slide shows the impact of dialysis fluid quality on anemia correction. Now, I mentioned to you right back at the start that without kidneys, you make no erythropoietin, and so red cell production is suppressed. And we get around that problem in dialysis patients by giving them recombinant human erythropoietin. But inflammation definitely counters the effects of erythropoietin. And what you see here in two different studies, and with two slightly different presentations of the data, is what happened to the ability of erythropoietin to improve red cell survival in patients treated first with a standard dialysate and then with a dialysis fluid that had been rendered ultra-pure by ultrafiltration. In the left-hand panel, you see that the dose of erythropoietin required significantly decreased. And in the right-hand panel, you see that for a fixed dose of erythropoietin, the hemoglobin, a measure of red cell production, significantly increased. So the next slide is just a kind of a summary of, and in the interest of time, we're not going to go through all of these, but it's pretty clear, I think, now that there are real advantages in using dialysis fluid of high microbiological purity, so-called ultra-pure dialysate. It's associated with a less inflammatory stimulus, a reduction in beta 2 microglobulin amyloid disease, improved responsiveness to erythropoietin, and another data that I haven't shown you, improved nutritional status such as higher albumins, better dry weights, and preservation of residual renal function, which is also very important in dialysis patients. So in the last part of my talk, I'd like to try to address that, having set ourselves this goal, how are we going to do it day in, day out, in a situation where I've already told you we've removed the substance that the municipal water supply puts in to prevent bacterial proliferation. So we've got basically water in which there's nothing to stop bacteria proliferating. How are we going to do it? Well, the next slide shows us the enemy. This is a bacterial biofilm. This is a piece of tubing from a dialysis machine, and you can see growing on the surface of the tubing a number of these rod-like organisms. And you'll appreciate, particularly up in the upper right-hand corner, this kind of amorphous-looking material that seems to be covering some of the bacteria. That's a glycocalyx material produced by the bacteria. It serves to protect them, and so they basically set up home between the surface of the tubing and this protective layer of glycocalyx material, biofilm, slime, whatever you want to call it. And once they do that, they are incredibly difficult to shift. So our strategies have to be directed towards the prevention of biofilm. Now, the next slide just tries to give you an indication of how the magnitude of this problem. So these are some studies that were done where a dialysis machine was deliberately contaminated with bacteria. And then it was subjected to the standard disinfection protocols that we use every day in our dialysis units. Now, after that, these investigators took samples of water from various tubing pathways in the machine, and they also took scrapings of the walls of the tubes, and they cultured them. And you can see they took from the water path, from the bicarbonate concentrate path, and from the path of the final dialysis fluid. And you can see in the water, there weren't very many bacteria. You know, it was somewhere between 12 and 23 normalized to the surface area of the tube. We wouldn't be typically very worried about that. But look what grew in the scrapings of the walls. Here we have in excess of 10,000 bacteria per square centimeter. So what I want to, the takeaway message from this is that if you allow this biofilm to form, standard disinfection protocols are very ineffective at getting rid of them, and all they will do is continually reinfect your system. So we need strategies to prevent this biofilm from forming. And the next slide talks about three different types of strategies. We need strategies that involve the design of our systems. We need strategies aimed at how we operate our systems. And we need strategies aimed at how we maintain our systems. And essentially here we are talking about disinfection. So the next slide is a very brief summary of some of the design considerations. These are things for the most part that you do once and hopefully you get them right. And they're not a problem thereafter. But important things are always keep the water and fluids moving. So the water coming from the water purification system should be distributed in a loop so that it's always moving, that it goes out to the machines, and anything that's left over comes back again. Stagnant flow is an environment that bacteria really like. So keeping the water moving is important. Having piping systems that do not have dead ends, not using bladder-type pressurizing tanks, not using multiple branching systems are all highly desirable. And keeping the pipes small enough in diameter that we keep the flow velocity in the pipe as high as practical given the constraints of pressure drops. We should use bacterial control devices such as ultrafilters, and devices such as online hot water pasteurization systems. They're very good for controlling bacterial growth. And if we use a storage tank, and there are many times when we have no option but to use a storage tank for our water, we should keep the size as small as possible so that the water turns over in the tank. If you have a very large tank, there's very little water turnover. It's certainly stagnant out at the walls of the tank, and that's a setup for biofilm formation. It should be pretty well sealed with a tight fitting lid and a filtered air vent. You need a conical bottom tank that you can drain at the lowest point, so when you disinfect it, you can disinfect all the surfaces. And there should be a convenient and adequate disinfection mechanism that enables you to disinfect all the internal surfaces of the tank. Now, I'm not going to say much more about design today. Most of us get our water systems from vendors who specialize in that sort of material, and they know these sorts of things. I'd like to go in the next slide to disinfection, because this, I think, is the key point to my talk today in the first bullet point, and that is that disinfection schedules should be designed to prevent contamination with bacteria and biofilm, not to eliminate bacteria and biofilm once they've established. Prevention, it's certainly all about prevention and not about cure. The disinfection should include everything: water storage and distribution system, concentrate preparation and distribution system, as well as the dialysis machines. And then we use monitoring with cultures and endotoxin levels as a means of verifying that our disinfection procedures are adequate and not as a means for telling us when we need to disinfect. That's a mindset that sometimes people have difficulty with. But this is all prospective, not retrospective. On the next slide, I want to say quickly a couple of words about how you do monitoring. This next slide shows how monitoring is supposed to be done in the United States and specifies certain culturing techniques, either membrane filter or spread plate. It specifies the agar, specifies the temperature, and it specifies the time for bacterial cultures, and then, of course, the lamellus amoebocyte lysate assay for endotoxin. Now, before I comment on the medium and the temperature and the time, let me say a couple of things about sample collection on the next slide, because sample collection is terribly important. You can either get contaminated samples or false negative samples if you're not careful. So first of all, sample ports should provide direct access to the fluid stream of interest. You should not have 4 foot of sidearm PVC tubing coming away from your sample port, because then all you're going to be doing is sampling that piece of PVC tubing, which is no real part of your water distribution system. You should flush the sample ports for at least 30 seconds before collecting the sample. And it's recommended that you do not disinfect the sample port. Now, the reason is that if there's any residual disinfectant left on the sample port and it gets into the sample, then it will kill any organisms that are there and you will get a false negative bacterial culture. So absolutely things like betadine or other long-lived disinfectants should not be used. There are some people that just cannot bear not to disinfect the sample port. For those people, the only real technique I think that has any validity is to use alcohol swabs. And then you have to make sure once you've applied the alcohol, isopropyl alcohol to the port to disinfect it, you have to then wait long enough for the alcohol to evaporate before you flush and draw the sample. Sample should be directly drawn into a sterile and toxin-free container and assayed as soon as possible. So that's sample collection. Now, how about culturing? There are certain things that to avoid and or not to avoid in culturing. First of all, a standard laboratory technique for culturing body fluids is to use something called a calibrated loop. It puts a very small volume of the sample onto the culture plate. The sample volume is too small for the sensitivity required when assaying dialysis fluids. And at least in the United States, use of calibrated loops is specifically prohibited, but you still come across them from time to time. If you're sending your samples to a hospital lab and always getting no growth, it is worth asking the question, how are you applying the sample to the plate? These things I call paddles here, these dip samplers, where you have a little container with a pad of medium that fits inside it, and you fill the container and the water's taken up by the dehydrated medium, reconstituted, and then you incubate them. They're very convenient for on-site sampling, but they have some problems, potentially. You absolutely need a good magnifier and a light source for accurate enumeration of the colonies. Some of the colonies are very small and you will not see them easily in poor light or with the naked eye. They may also give an apparent false negative if you have heavily contaminated samples, because the colonies will grow to confluence on the little plate and it'll look like there's nothing there. So you have to be very careful if you use those. I think it is advisable always to have a backup where you send a duplicate sample once in a while to a lab for other methods and compare the results. And then membrane filtration is probably the very best method. It's very sensitive and it uses large sample volumes. It's a little more complicated to do, but it's the most sensitive way we have. Now, I'd like to say a couple of quick words about culture and conditions, because it is important to realize that the result you get back from the lab is not an absolute count. It's a count that depends on how you did the culture, both in terms of the medium you used, the temperature, and the incubation time. And this just shows here on a log scale on this next slide that three different agars, blood agar, tryptic soy agar, and TGEA, and with TGEA at two different temperatures, that the same sample incubated under those four different sets of conditions can give a colony count that varies by almost two orders of magnitude. So there's no right answer to this. What is important to know is that if you get some count, it's a relative count. And the more sensitive assaying systems will give you certainly higher levels of bacteria than the less sensitive ones. On the next slide, I would like to just say one thing very briefly about disinfecting dialysis machines, because I think this is also very important. And that has to do with what is called no man's land on this line on this slide, which is the line, the water inlet line between the water outlet on the wall and the back of the dialysis machine. I call it no man's line because no one wants to own it. The water system people say that's part of the machine, not part of the water system. And the dialysis machine manufacturers who give you very nice protocols for disinfecting their machines, basically those protocols disinfect everything downstream of this line, but never retrograde. So this line is not automatically disinfected. And that means that for the dialysis facility, you have to have made a conscious decision to put a mechanism in place to periodically disinfect these lines. And you see here on the right-hand panel is how the line should look, nice and clean, and the color of the tubing. And you see on the left-hand side a section of tubing, which is some color. You see them all colors, black, green, brown. If your clear tubing looks colored like that, that's almost certainly biofilm. And once you've got it, it's very hard to get rid of it. So let me now close with two or three slides talking about strategies for cleaning, disinfecting, and trying to eliminate biofilm. So the first, the next slide, is really just outlines a study that I'm going to show you the results for in a minute. But here, silicon rubber tubing was exposed to contaminated dialysate and allowed to develop a biofilm on its surface. And the biofilm was pretty profound. It was 15 microns thick and covered 96% of the surface area and contained more than a billion organisms per mil of Pseudomonas species. Then that tubing was cleaned with 3% citric acid or not, for 5 minutes before disinfection by various procedures for 40 minutes. And the results of the study, which I think are very interesting, are shown on the next slide. It's a little bit of a busy slide. I'll try to walk you through it and give you two or three take-home messages. So in the left-hand column, you see whether there was cleaning or not. So the dash means there was no cleaning, and then it was cleaned with citric acid. And then four different disinfection protocols. Dilute bleach at 20 degrees centigrade, Actril at 20 degrees centigrade, citric acid at 90 degrees centigrade, water at 90 degrees centigrade, and then a more concentrated bleach solution. The next two columns talk about the change in biofilm following these cleaning and disinfection procedures, how much reduction in thickness there was, and how much reduction in coverage there was. And then from the final two columns show the residual bacteria and endotoxin left after the procedures. Now, what I think you can quickly see is that if you don't clean with citric acid, doesn't matter what disinfecting agent you use, the results are worse than if you do first clean with citric acid. So cleaning with an acid is important. It's probably important because it leaches calcium out of the biofilm matrix, and allows better penetration of the disinfecting agent. Bleach is a little bit better than Actril, but what is, I think, important is that heat, whether it's heat with citric acid or heat alone, was pretty ineffective. And in fact, this has been described as using hot water on a contaminated tubing is just all you are doing is baking the biofilm in place. So I think these, if you don't clean first, it doesn't, and you, temperature, heat alone will not fix your problem. The next slide shows a similar sort of thing here for several other conditions. Again, now looking at bleach alone, at peracetic acid, at heat, and then citric acid plus heat. And what you see is the counts before disinfection in the gray bar, the yellow bar immediately afterwards, and in the aqua bar 24 hours later. And what you'll appreciate with bleach, peracetic acid, and heat, where there was no cleaning, is a pretty prompt rebound within 24 hours, whereas that rebound is much more subdued if you submitted the surface to a cleaning with citric acid first. The next slide, which I think is really quite interesting, is something that came out towards the end of last year and shows a new cleaning approach that's been developed in France using an enzyme detergent solution on biofilm. And so what you see here is contaminated tubing that was treated with either their enzyme detergent mixture, peracetic acid, or hot citric acid. And you see the bacterial counts, the endotoxin counts, and the biofilm coverage. And what is noted is that you don't see yellow bars. So the enzyme solution completely removed the biofilm cover. There was no residual endotoxin. And that's in stark difference to using either a peracetic acid alone or citric acid alone. The next slide, and my second last slide, very briefly shows another strategy that I think is important towards producing ultra-pure dialysate, and that is the use of point-of-use ultrafilters. After the dialysate has been, the dialysis solution has been proportioned from water and concentrate, it is then passed through another ultrafilter before it enters the dialyzer. And you see on the back of the machine in the right-hand panel, the two ultrafilters, and in the schematic diagram, you can see how the water comes in, it's combined with the concentrates, and then passes through the ultrafilter before going to the dialyzer. A well-maintained system with such point-of-use ultrafilters will routinely provide you with ultra-pure dialysate. And so I come to the end of my last slide. Just a quick summary. Dialysis patients are highly sensitive to contaminants in the water used for preparing dialysis fluid and for preprocessing dialyzers. That microbiological contaminants may contribute to many problems common in dialysis patients, including long-term, fairly slow-developing problems such as beta-2 microglobulin amyloid disease, anemia, and malnutrition. And that avoiding these complications requires a well-designed water purification and distribution system, a rigorous and prospective disinfection schedule, and constant attention to water quality. And I'm going to finish there, and Paul, that gives us 1 minute for questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dick. 1 minute, that's not a lot we can fit in there.
I'm sorry, it kind of always rolls on a little longer than I meant
fine.
It to.
That's fine, you're very stimulating. It was a really interesting teleclass lecture, and I must say it's much easier to hear you explain these things than it is to read it in a journal. I have a quick question, and then I will have to close.
Mm-hmm.
How different in terms of disinfection and that process is it for a home dialysis machine as compared to a dialysis clinic?
Yeah, it is. The processes should be very similar. The problem with a home dialysis patient is that they only use the machine three times. Well, that depends now. If they're doing nocturnal, which is common in parts of Canada, they're using it almost every day, and that's not so bad. The less frequently it's used, the more the water is just sitting around, and the more it's growing bacteria. And so you really need to be, you know, particularly, you have to keep really after it with home machines. It's a real challenge. And I think that, you know, that's certainly a case where the point of use ultrafilters are strongly indicated, together with a vigorous disinfection program. But it's the most difficult circumstance we have, almost the most difficult. I think the most difficult are in single portable dialysis machines that are moved around on a hospital for doing acute dialysis. Because they're always being connected, disconnected, contaminated, not contaminated, sitting for 3 days because they're not used. They're the biggest challenge.
Thank you all for joining the teleclass today. A special thanks to Dr. Ward for this presentation and presenting some outstanding information in an outstanding way. Thank you very much. Until we talk again, folks, goodbye.